Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at tanger.com.
The following episode will contain the names of people and places set in the fictional world of the Hyborian Age. Furthermore, if I am unable to find these names spoken aloud on YouTube or in an audiobook, they are names that I will certainly pronounce incorrectly in almost every single instance. Listener discretion is advised.
You know who you are?
Stephen is my name. Even Stephen.
Will you say something, Stephen?
Stephen or Else Media.
Imagine that it's the Hyborian Age, and you're a Turanian soldier, part of a troop sent forth into the desolate hills, where barren rock and jagged boulders dominate the landscape. The sun is dipping low, casting long, sharp shadows over the terrain, and your every step crunches against gravel, the sound unnervingly loud in the oppressive silence. The mission seems straightforward at first. Quell a band of rebellious hillmen who dared to defy Turin's might. But the enemy knew these hills better than you or your comrades ever could. The ambush came swift and merciless, their war cries echoing off the rocks as arrows and spears rained down from unseen heights. Men fell before they could even draw their weapons. Panic rippled through your ranks, and the troop was scattered like leaves in a storm. By some cruel twist of fortune, you survived. Now, huddled in the shadow of a shallow cave, you can feel the weight of despair pressing down on what's left of your unit. Captain Malthus, bloodied but unbowed, paces near the cave entrance, his expression grim as he assesses the situation. The hillmen have made their demand, a duel between champions to determine the fate of the survivors. The terms are clear. Victory means freedom, defeat means death. But as you glance at your comrades, the reality sinks in. There's no one among you who stands a chance against their champion, Turek. The name alone carries weight, muttered in hushed, fearful tones. You've heard the stories, a brute of impossible size, twice the height of any ordinary man, and his strength is rumored to be more than human. When Turek finally steps into view, your stomach knots. Even from a distance, he's a towering silhouette against the darkening sky, his massive frame draped in crude armor fashioned from the hides of beasts, and his footsteps send small pebbles skittering down the rocky slopes, each movement exuding raw power. Captain Malthus curses under his breath, his face pale. His knuckles whiten around the hilt of his sword as he gazes toward the monstrous figure of Turek. "If only I had an enchanted blade," he mutters. The words are heavy with resignation, his tone bitter. Of course, everyone knows there's no such thing as a magic sword. No divine weapon waiting to tip the scales in their favor. All there is cold steel, and the cold certainty that it won't be enough. The weight of hopelessness hangs thick in the air, and you see it mirrored in the eyes of the men around you. As Malthus prepares to step forward, his jaw clenched and shoulders squared in grim determination, the sound of movement behind him barely registers. Before anyone can react, Conan appears, his steps deliberate, his presence like the shadow of a predator. Without warning, the barbarian strikes. His fist connects with the back of the captain's head with a sickening thud, and Malthus collapses to the rocky ground in a limp heap. A stunned silence falls over the group, broken only by the distant wind howling through the barren hills. Gasps ripple through the survivors, their eyes darting between the fallen captain and the imposing Cimmerian now standing in his place. Conan doesn't speak. He doesn't need to. His piercing gaze shifts to the looming figure of Turek, his expression unreadable but resolute. The tension crackles like a storm about to break. Whatever fear or doubt may have lingered among the men, none dare voice it. The barbarian's audacity is as terrifying as it is galvanizing. And with that, Conan steps forward to face the giant. From Stephen R. Else Media, this is Hither Came Conan, and our deep dive into Conan the Barbarian number 31 from Marvel Comics. Welcome to Hither Came Conan, the podcast that spends at least 30 minutes every night before bed sharpening its sword. You know, just in case. Just in case what? I have no idea. You ask me, I think the podcast is a little paranoid. I'm your host, my name is Steven, and frankly, I could probably spend an hour or more every night sharpening a sword, you know, just sitting there in front of my TV watching my shows and sharpening my sword. Sounds actually quite relaxing. Of course, I have no idea if spending so much time each day doing all that sharpening is either good or bad for the sword. I mean, on the one hand, that sword is going to be sharp like a frickin' razor, right? On the other hand, would I just be reducing the blade, wearing it down over time until it's just a toothpick? I don't know. No idea. You know who would know, though? Conan. Conan would know. Unfortunately, he's fictional, so we can't ask him, which is too bad because he seems to be a sword expert. And speaking of Conan and swords, in today's episode, we're going to be looking at an issue that deals with an incident in Conan's past and his encounter with a magical, one might even say cursed, sword. It's all here in today's issue, Conan the Barbarian, number 31. This issue sports a cover date of October 1973, though it hit the stands in July. It sold for just 20 cents, and it is entitled The Shadow in the Tomb. It was written by Roy Thomas, with pencils by John Buscema, inks by Ernie Chan. The letters were by John Costanza, and Glynis Ween was the colorist.
Into the boat!
Conan finds himself in the middle of a Turanian military campaign against a band of rebellious hillmen. The skirmish quickly turns dire as the hillmen launch a devastating ambush, leaving Conan and a small group of survivors under Captain Malthus to retreat to a nearby cave for refuge. The hillmen trap them inside and offer a bargain. A Turanian champion will fight a hillman to the death. Captain Malthus reluctantly agrees to the challenge, but doubts arise about their chances against Turek, the Hillman's towering champion, without the aid of a magical weapon. This sparks Conan's memory of a cursed magic sword he had once discarded in Vanaheim. As dusk falls and their predicament grows dire, Conan seizes the moment, knocking Malthus unconscious and stepping forward as the Turanian champion. The duel is fierce, with Conan clearly outmatched by Turek's immense strength. However, the barbarian's cunning prevails as he lures the hillmen into a trap, triggering a landslide that buries his opponent. Conan secures safe passage for the surviving Turanians, leaving behind a tale of grit, strategy, and barbarian ingenuity. All right, so in Barbarian Life, a literary biography of Conan the Barbarian, Volume 1, Roy Thomas tells us that in 1973, he had Marvel's lawyers hard at work securing the rights to adapt the Conan stories written by L. Sprague de Camp and Lynn Carter, as well as Bjorn Nyberg, who was a Scandinavian co-author of a few of those Conan tales. And he wanted all these so he could make up some stories using those stories for the Conan the Barbarian comic. The collaboration with Lynn Carter sailed through with a little bother. Conan the Barbarian number 30, as we know from the previous episode, featured the Hand of Nergal, a tale that Carter had completed from an unfinished Robert E. Howard story fragment. Meanwhile, Roy began work on two additional adaptations, The City of Skulls, which he intended for Neil Adams to illustrate, and The Thing in the Crypt, which was assigned to John Buscema. Roy also mentions a rumor that The Thing in the Crypt might have started as a Thanagore of Lemuria story by Carter, later reworked into a Conan tale with DeCamps' input. However, he noted that such transformations were common. Howard's The Phoenix on the Sword, Conan's debut, had begun as a Cole story, after all. Roy tells us that he considered The Thing in the Crypt a fairly derivative tale, influenced by films like The Seventh Voyage of Sinbad and Jason and the Argonauts, which featured heroes battling animated skeletons. Still, he thought it might work well enough as a brief episode from Conan's early life. Chronologically, it predated The Tower of the Elephant, taking place after Conan escaped Hyperborean slavery as a teenager. Well, if you recall, Roy had already written a story in which Conan was hanging with the Hyperboreans way back in issue number 3 when he adapted Howard's The Gray God Passes into the twilight of the grim gray god. But knowing that it wouldn't be long until he had the rights to The Thing in the Crypt, Roy figured out a way to fit it into Marvel's Conan continuity. Instead of tying it directly to Conan's adventures with the Hyperboreans in issue number 3, he set the revised tale earlier during Conan's youthful skirmishes in the Aesir-Vanir border wars. To emphasize this timeline, Buscema drew the young Sumerian wearing his signature horned helmet from the series' earlier issues. And so, by the time Roy gets to Conan the Barbarian number 31, he had planned to present The Thing in the Crypt as a flashback within a larger story. The main narrative would show Conan and his Turanian comrades ambushed by hillmen and cornered in a cave. A remark about a magic sword would prompt Conan to recall the events of The Thing in the Crypt, where he had claimed a blade from a mummified skeleton, inadvertently awaking it in the process. Buscema had already completed the first 4 pages of the story when the plan hit a bit of a snag. DeCamp wasn't quite ready to approve any comic book adaptations of his Conan work. He had some reservations that, well, Roy never did find out what they were. Regardless, DeCamp's waffling forced Roy to make a bit of a change. Rather than a flashback in which Conan finds a magical sword and has to battle its skeleton-slash-mummy guardian, he instead writes a flashback in which Conan finds a magical sword and is then forced to do battle with his own shadow, which had been a suggestion from Roy's then-wife, Jean. And that, folks, is how we get this issue. An almost adaptation of The Thing in the Crypt. Now, eventually, DeCamp gave his approval and Roy did adapt The Thing in the Crypt, but that wasn't until 1978 with issue number 92 of Conan the Barbarian. So it's going to be a bit before we talk about it. Until then, folks, get your brains ready, because we's about to dive. All right, so this cover is another Gil Kane cover, inked by John Romita, and it features Conan trying to pull a sword from a crypt or a big stone coffin. And there's a skeletal hand coming up out of the coffin, gripping the blade of the sword as Conan, he's kind of crouched over it and using both his hands and his arms to try to pull the sword out like he's trying to pull the sword from the stone. And behind him is his shadow on the wall. And originally it was just his shadow, but it's holding a sword looking like it's about to strike Conan down. And originally it was just this all black shadow, but somebody then had the idea of giving the shadow on the cover a pair of evil red eyes. Could have been Gil, could have been John, could have been Roy. Nobody knows. But you don't see those eyes within the issue. However, on the cover, they put the eyes on to make it look, I guess, more menacing. But it's an all right cover, I suppose. It's very, very Gil Kane, especially the designs on the side of the big stone crypt or coffin or whatever the hell you want to call it. That's very Gil Kane. I can see Gil Kane in those bits. Getting into the book, we get an opening splash page of this battle between the Turanian soldiers and the hillmen, and it looks very savage, very well done, very John Buscema, especially the close-up of the dude's face in the corner, screaming out, "Death! Death to the murderous minions of Yildiz!" I doubt hillmen sound like that, but That's the voice I use, folks, and I am sticking to it. So there's really not a lot to get into with this issue. I mean, when we're talking about a deep dive, there's just really not a lot. There's a great panel on the second page where Conan sticks his sword through the belly of one of these hillmen. It's the very first panel, and the look of surprise on that guy's face as he has like a yard of steel sticking through him. It's a great, great John Buscema panel there. But the battle is not going in the Turanians' favor, and the captain, Malthus, he orders everybody into a retreat to fall back onto the slopes. The captain seems to be, I don't know if he is new to this rank, if this is one of his first expeditions, but he seems very, they describe him as being very into it. He's very excited about getting out there and, you know, punishing these hillmen. And he is, well, he's of noble lineage. And so at first you kind of assume that maybe these soldiers don't take him very seriously, that he's not a great captain. You know, he's too well bred, I guess, and maybe a bit of a coward. That's kind of the first impression that you get. But they quickly turn that back around to say that Conan quite likes the captain. He admires him to a certain extent because he's not a bad man. And there's even a point where the captain, when he calls the retreat, he sends everybody up into the hills. One of the soldiers protests, you know, the hillmen are going to know these hills better than us. But the captain points out that, first of all, that's an order and you have to follow my orders. And secondly, there's a ravine up ahead where once they're into it, the hillmen can only follow through one at a time. So it kind of evens the score that way. They're just taking men out one on one. And Conan, of course, is in the rear and he is kind of holding off this horde of hillmen right there at the entrance to this ravine. So it's just Conan killing men one at a time. But the captain comes back for him, tells him that, you know, you need to come with us. Because as much of an ass kicker as you are, you're not going to do us any good if you end up getting killed. So Conan agrees. They make their escape. They make their way through like a field of these rocky outcroppings and just these, it's like giant stones balanced atop columns of stone. They look very precarious. They look like they could fall at any moment. If they make the wrong step and accidentally bump into one of these columns, then all these giant boulders will fall down atop them and kill them. And that is a bit of foreshadowing. We're going to remember this spot. Because it's not far from the cave where they end up taking their rest to try to recuperate, to try to regroup, lick their wounds, and get ready for when the hillmen come and attack. Rather than attack, however, the leader of the hillmen, Hobar, which sounds a little too close to Hothar of the Hill People, an old SNL sketch. Here, I'm sorry, did I say Hothar? I meant Lothar. Y'all knew that, right? Lothar of the Hill People, not Hothar. I'm thinking of Hodor, but it's Lothar. Anyway, here's the bit that I am just itching to play and yet can't seem to get to it. Here you go!
I am Lothar of the Hill People. Much have I seen and much have I done. Join us, will you not? For I am Lothar of the Hill People.
Wasn't that fun? Anyway, Hobar, he calls up to the Turanians and he offers them a way out. He says if their champion will fight the champion of the Hillmen, this giant of a man named Turuk, well, if they fight and the Turanian champion wins, then the Turanians can go free and no one else has to die. If Turuk wins, however, well, it's not going to be good for the Turanians. We'll just put it that way.
Hither Came Conan will return after these messages.
Remember the magic of Saturday mornings? A time when waking up early wasn't a chore, it was an adventure. Those hours were sacred. A weekly ritual that pulled us into worlds of animated heroes, villains, and endless possibilities. Hey folks, I'm Steven, and I want to welcome you to my new podcast, Growing Up Geek, a temporal odyssey through the geek-centric cultural zeitgeist of my youth. From the 70s through the 80s and on into the 90s, we'll explore the movies, the music, the books, the comics, and the TV shows that shaped my childhood and made me, well, me. In our first season, we're diving into the golden age of Saturday morning cartoons, the history, the magic, and the cultural impact these shows had on a generation. So grab your cereal, settle in, and let's relive those iconic Saturday mornings together. Whether you're a lifelong geek who lived for those Saturday morning lineups, or someone curious about the cartoons that defined a generation, Growing Up Geek is the show for you. So subscribe now to make sure that you don't miss a minute of the fun, nostalgia, and stories that defined our weekends. You know, when we were growing up geek.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at tanger.com.
And now back to Hither Came Conan. Malthus agrees, and as they wait in the cave, because the battle is going to be at sundown, so as they wait till sundown, that's when Malthus, as he's looking down at this giant Turok that he has to fight, he wishes aloud that his blade was an enchanted blade, that he had a magic sword. But he says that there's no such thing as a magic sword, which is too bad, because he really could use one against this giant of a hill man. The mention of a magic sword, however, has Conan thinking back. It has him getting all nostalgic, and he's remembering his days. It doesn't seem that long ago when he was with the Icer fighting the Vannermen, and we get this bit of art here from John Buscema. He draws Conan in that, I guess, costume that he was wearing, basically, in issue one. He's got the horned helmet. He's got the three discs hanging around his neck. He's got his little fur trunks, all that stuff. And John Buscema almost gives him a Barry Windsor Smith kind of look. He slims him up a little. You know, Barry Windsor Smith's Conan was muscular, but kind of a slim, muscly guy, if that makes any sense. He's more of a just a toned, fit dude. And that's how Buscema kind of draws him here. So Conan's remembering back. He's running from some Vannermen. He hides. He escapes being caught. And then he is attacked by a bear. He kills the bear, and they both fall into this underground chamber. Now, the bear, I should say, if you remember issue number two, think way back to issue number two, The Lair of the Beast Men. When it opens, Conan is standing over the dead body of a giant beast man that he has just killed. Originally, that was supposed to be a big bear. And Marvel, the folks at Marvel, Stan or somebody, made him change it. They wanted a beast man right there, front and center. And so this is Roy's way of kind of bringing the fight with the bear back into the comics by adding it here to this bit. But bear dies. They're in this underground chamber. Conan pulls himself to his feet. His sword is stuck in the neck of this bear. And when he pulls it out, he finds that it's actually broken. The sword snapped in half as they fell. And so Conan makes himself a little fire and realizes that he's not just in some kind of underground natural cave. He's in what appears to be some kind of tomb. And he starts investigating and looking around, and he finds this big stone coffin. And sticking out of the top of the stone coffin is this skeletal arm with a skeletal hand, and it's clutching a sword in its sheath. The sword has a skull on it as a pommel, which, I don't know, should immediately alert anybody that it's probably not the best sword in the world. If you have to put a skull there, that, I don't know, to me, that kind of screams of, danger, cursed sword, you know, or at least this sword was wielded by a really bad dude. But Conan doesn't care. He needs a sword. His sword is broken. And so he takes the sword from out of the scabbard. And the moment he does, his shadow on the wall behind him just attacks. It grows form and it becomes solid and it attacks Conan. And Conan has to fight it. In the end, Conan can't really best his own shadow. At one point, he actually slashes at the shadow and it just passes through the shadow as if it was nothing more than a shadow. But Conan strikes upon this idea where he starts throwing all these tapestries and these cloth curtains and wall hangings. He throws them on the fire. And basically, the entire tomb erupts into flame. And there is so much light now that is being shown throughout this tomb. The light is so bright that there are no shadows, and that causes the shadow demon to go away. Conan escapes from the burning tomb, using the body of the bear to spring off of to jump back up to the surface level. He uses some snow to ease the burns that are now on him from the fire. And then he tosses the sword back into the rocky chamber below, into the cave tomb thing. With the flashback over, we're now back in the present. The sun is sinking into the horizon. Turok comes forward, ready for battle. Captain Malthus, he's got his shield, his sword, it's a scimitar. He's got his little helmet on, his cloak. He's ready to go out and do battle. All the men, you know, I think they know that they're not going to survive this. There's no way their captain can beat this giant of a man. And Conan just decides to take his destiny into his own hands, comes up behind Malthus, clocks him in the back of the head, knocks the guy out, grabs up the captain's shield, has his own sword, and then he heads out to do battle with this giant of a man who literally is twice as big as Conan. He's just this huge frickin' dude. And they start fighting, and it's very clear from the beginning that as powerful as Conan is, he, you know, strength to strength, he's not going to be able to outmatch Turok. And so using his brains instead, which is kind of nice to see that in this book, that, you know, here's twice that Conan has come up against something in this issue. First, this shadow demon, and now this giant barbarian. He can't use his brawn and his skill with the sword to win the day. So he has to use his brains. And so he lures Turok into that field of rocks where there were these giant boulders perched upon columns, and just it was a very deadly looking place. And Conan throws his own sword at one of these precariously perched rocks, and everything just starts falling. Conan leaps away so that he is not buried under all this rock, but of course Turok is. And the hillmen are as good as their word, and they let the Turanians go. And the hillmen just kind of slink off into the night while Conan and the Turanians take off in their own direction. And as the issue ends, we see Turok's hand come out. It's sticking out after all these boulders and junk fell on top of him. The only thing that we can see of him is his hand sticking out from under one of these boulders, and the hand is clutching a sword. And then suddenly the hand loosens because the guy's dead, and the sword falls. And as the sword hits the ground, we see that it is the very same cursed sword from Conan's flashback, the sword with the skull on the pommel. And there's a little bit earlier where Conan's kind of wondering if he had held on to that sword, would it have made this battle easier? Would he have been able to just cut the dude down and win? And then we learn here at the end, no, because the other dude had the magic sword and he lost. So it's kind of a nice conclusion. I mean, again, not a lot happens. There's not a lot of big, deep philosophical wonderings and whatnot within this issue. There's not a lot to dive into too deep. But I really like this idea that Conan, twice in this issue, has to use his brain over his brawn, and that wielding a magic sword doesn't mean jack, especially if you're going up against Conan. It was a good story. It was a good issue. I mean, we're kind of at this area, or these stories now are just kind of, I don't want to use the term generic. They're Conan stories. They're fun. They're not earth shattering. They're not defining the genre. They're not changing the genre. They're not doing anything anything more than what you would want these Conan stories to do, which is just to tell fun little tales of this barbarian getting into adventures. And that's what happened here. And here's something that I could point out that we haven't seen yet, I don't think. Well, I don't want to say we haven't seen it yet, because we have seen covers with just Conan on them. But this is another one. They didn't stick a girl in this issue, and they didn't stick a girl on the cover, which hasn't happened very often. I can think of one off the top of my head that had Conan on the cover, and that was it. No girls, no damsel in distress. And I'm fairly certain that that one probably had a girl within the issue, but this one has neither. No girl on the cover, no girl in the issue. Just Conan fighting against a bunch of other barbarians with his civilized comrades in arms, however you want to say that. But there are a couple of moments, or at least one moment that I can recall, and I think it was Malthus himself. He refers to the hillmen. They're in their cave and they're hiding, they're waiting. I guess the hillmen have approached to make their offer, and Malthus refers to them as unbathed barbarians. And then, of course, he looks at Conan, who's just kind of sitting there on the cave floor, and he tells him, no offense, Northlander, because Conan would be an unbathed barbarian. But that's it. That's the issue. That is all I have to say about Conan the Barbarian, number 31, The Shadow in the Tomb. What'd you think? Did you enjoy it? I had fun with it. How about you? Anything you want to add? You have any deeper insights? Did I get something wrong? Did I miss something? Is there something that you're like, why didn't you talk about this? Let me know. Feedback at hithercameconan.com. And who knows, maybe I'll read it out on a future episode. So before I let you go, I wanted to debut a new segment here on Hither Came Conan. It might not make it into every episode, but with this one being rather short, I thought I'd give it a try and see what happened. I'm calling the segment Historic Hyboria, and it's going to be a short lesson on Hyborian people, places, and or things. And since we've been spending a lot of time in Turin over the last, 12 issues or so, I figured Turin would be a good place to start. And so, ladies and gentlemen, I introduce to you Historic Hyboria. Turin, one of the most fascinating and expansive empires in the Hyborian Age, was founded by adventurous Hyrcanian settlers. These pioneers ventured westward, settling the shores of the Viliet Sea. And over time, their modest state grew into a dominant empire. The Turanians always retained pride in their Hyrcanian heritage, and their cultural and military legacy reflected this deep connection to their origins. By Conan's time, Turin was a place of aggressive expansion, asserting its dominance over vast swaths of land. Its influence extended across many neighboring regions, with the rulers of Brithunia, Shem, Koth, and Zamora paying tribute to their eastern overlord. The reach of Turin's military ambitions wasn't limited to these territories. Its armies challenged the borders of Carinthia, Hyperborea, Numidia, Ophir, Stygia, and even Vendaea. The Viliet Sea itself, a sprawling body of water measuring 2,000 miles in length and 300 miles across, had become the domain of the Turanian Navy. This maritime dominance allowed the empire to control trade routes and secure its position as a preeminent power in the region. The empire's military history is marked by significant conflicts, including the mysterious Great War with Kitai. Though the details are sparse, this war is remembered for the massive casualties inflicted upon the Kitans. Turin's appetite for expansion and conquest was evident, but so too was the resilience of its enemies. Conan himself, well, he had many encounters with Turin, both as an adversary and an ally. One such tale recounts his time resting south of the Viliet Sea where he faced a giant reptile known as a Lakmu. After surviving the creature and quicksand, Conan crossed paths with a tortured Stygian and a stolen religious idol, plunging him into a web of intrigue and supernatural danger. Later, as a mercenary in the Turanian army, Conan fought against rebel hillmen tribes. In one harrowing encounter, his group was ambushed and trapped in a cave. Conan, ever the warrior, volunteered to fight in a deadly duel against the hillmen's champion, securing his comrades' freedom in a dramatic and decisive battle. Turin's wealth was bolstered by its thriving economy, driven in large part by its port cities. The capital, Agrippur, stood as a beacon of trade and governance, while Zamboula, its westernmost outpost, was equally renowned. Zamboula was a bustling hub of commerce and culture, though not without its darker sides. Here, a subordinate ruler presided over a mixed population of Stygians and Shemites, with markets offering slaves from distant lands. The city had a sinister reputation, including a slave force from Darfar known for practicing cannibalism. In these marketplaces, one could find exotic goods and grim realities side by side. Despite its strength, Turin faced significant internal challenges. Pirate strongholds dotted the Vilayet Sea, and Kozakai raiders frequently plundered the Empire's provincial cities. These groups persisted despite repeated attempts by the government and military to eliminate them. Culturally, Turin offered a rich tapestry of traditions. The people spoke Hyrcanian, a nod to their heritage, and their cuisine was equally distinctive. Turin kebabs were a local specialty, while flatbreads and a brew called shakai were common in the eastern desert. Religion in Turin was as diverse as its people, with practices ranging from the worship of Hunaman by Zamboula's lower classes to darker pagan sects engaging in sacrificial rituals. The influence of ancient deities like Erlik, Tarim, and even the White Wolf, a pre-cataclysmic age deity, shaped the spiritual lives of Turanians. The Sons of the White Wolf, a renegade group formed by mutinous Turanian soldiers, exemplified the Empire's turbulent religious dynamics. Turin stands as a testament to the grandeur and complexity of the Hyborian Age, a land of sweeping power, cultural richness, and enduring conflict. Whether through its naval dominance, its bustling markets, or its indomitable warriors, Turin's legacy endures in the tales of Conan and the lore of its world. For an empire forged by Hyrcanian adventurers, it truly grew to become a force that shaped the course of its age. And there you have it, folks, a treasure from the vaults of historic Hyboria. There's still a lot more to tell about Turin, but considering that we haven't yet reached those stories in the comics, we'll leave it here for now.
Everybody out!
Next time on Hither Came Conan, our hero finds himself in the mysterious city of Wen Tangri, where flames whisper warnings, stolen gems summon deadly vipers, and danger lurks in every shadow. Chased by soldiers, betrayed by magic, and lured into the watery depths of a monstrous trap, Conan must summon all his strength and cunning to survive a city ruled by sorcery. But even as he escapes one peril, an ominous shadow looms closer. It's all that and more in Conan the Barbarian number 32, Flame Winds of Lost Kitai, published by Marvel Comics in August of 1973. The synopsis used in this episode was taken from MarvelFandom.com and then altered, twisted, rewritten, and added to by me. The information used in this episode comes from Wikipedia, along with Mike's Amazing World of Comics at Mike'sAmazingWorld.com, and the book, Barbarian Life, A Literary Biography of Conan the Barbarian, Volume 1 by Roy Thomas, which you can get now at SumerianPress.com. And finally, the views and opinions expressed within this episode are mine and mine alone, and do not reflect the official policy or position of Marvel Comics, Roy Thomas, the Howard Estate, Conan, his sword, his steely thews, his many fans and supporters, and especially his god, Crom.
Crom laps with the four winds.
So until next time, folks, keep your swords close by, never stop treading them jeweled thrones, and as always, be nice to each other. Bye! I want to thank you for listening to this episode of Hither Came Conan. Questions and comments can be directed to feedback@hithercameconan.com. If you enjoyed the show, you can help to boost our presence online by leaving a rating or review on your favorite podcast app. I also invite you to join our subscription program, Stephen or Else Beyond, and in return, you'll get episodes of Hither Came Conan early and ad-free. Check out the link in the show notes, or just go to hithercameconan.com to sign up today. Hither Came Conan is a presentation of Stephen or Else Media. For more nerdy content hosted by me, check out somanypodcasts.com. All links will be in the show notes. Turin, one of the most fascinating and expansive empires in the
Some hard stuff to say.
Hard to say this stuff.
Religion in Turin was as diverse as its people, with practices ranging from the worship of Hunaman by Zambula's blower poopies. Hunaman by Zambula. Hunaman. Shaft. Damn right.
I just don't think I can move through life knowing that a guy named Steven did this to me.
How could you let this happen, Steven?
Your podcast sucks.
Enough talk.
Great Crom.
Experience holiday cheer at Tanger Outlets with savings up to 70% off your favorite brands. From fragrances to accessories and the latest styles, discover the best gifts for everyone on your list. Save big at Nike Factory Store, Michael Kors, Under Armour, Coach, Polo Ralph Lauren, Kate Spade New York, and so many more. Unwrap the best at Tanger Outlets. Hundreds of brands, endless gifting options. Plan your trip at Tanger.com.